One could never have enough socks, said Dumbledore. Another Christmas has come and gone, and I didn't get a single pair. People will insist on giving me books.
Readers, welcome to this special holiday edition of The Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles, and I'm ready to take you along on a merry holiday literary romp. We'll mix new Christmas titles, those feel-good heartwarmers like the newest from today's guest, Debbie Maycomber, with books that spice it up with a dash of murder and mayhem. And just in case you need a few last-minute gift-giving ideas, I've sprinkled in several titles that made Amazon's 2014 Best Of list for mystery, nonfiction, and entertainment. As a special treat, we'll hear a Christmas confection from Pete Larkin, a wonderfully popular audiobook performer. So, find yourself a comfy corner, a cup of eggnog, and we'll begin as we turn to page one of the book report.
Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. What if Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store? What if Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more?
In Winter Street, Ellen Hildebrand's first Christmas novel, a family gathers on Nantucket for a holiday filled with surprises. Kelly is looking forward to the family get-together, but when he walks in on Mitzi kissing Santa Claus, or the guy who's playing Santa at the inn's annual party, chaos descends. With the three older children each reeling in their own dramas and Bart unreachable in Afghanistan, it might be up to Kelly's ex-wife, nightly news anchor Margaret Quinn, to save Christmas. Erin Bennett performs this heartwarmer about coming home for the holidays.
Ava is hoarse, and her fingers ache. If she never plays Jingle Bells again, it will be too soon. It is, hands down, the least interesting carol ever written. Why does everyone love it so? She feels like Sisyphus with his boulder. She will have to play it at least one more time at the annual Christmas Eve party at the inn. There will be no escaping that. Still, there is something magical about the afternoon. The sky is sterling silver, the air shimmering with mist. It's chilly, but probably too warm for snow. Ava stands at the flagpole and waves to her students, who are waving madly back at her through the fogged-up windows of the school bus.
Merry Christmas, Miss Quinn. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas!
How Ava longs to be 8 again. Or no, not 8, but 5. She was 5 years old the Christmas before her parents split. Ava sees Claire Fry, wearing a long red coat and a matching red hat set precariously on top of her dark curls, run into her father's arms. Her father, Gavin Fry, who looks like the pirate Bluebeard, picks Claire up and swings her around so that her hat sails through the air and hits the damp pavement. Gavin retrieves Claire's hat and from his pocket pulls a wax paper bag that Ava knows has come from the Nantucket Bake Shop.
That was Winter Street by Ellen Hildebrand. Anne Perry's A New York Christmas is not a warm, fuzzy Christmas tale, but an irresistible story of love, betrayal, greed, and murder in New York City, 1904. 23-year-old Jemima Pitt, daughter of Thomas Pitt, head of Britain's special branch, has crossed the Atlantic with Delphinia Cardew. Delphinia is set to marry Brent Albright in a grand affair that will join together two fabulously wealthy families. But Jemima senses a mysterious shadow darkening the occasion. Delphinia's mother, Maria, is missing from the festivities. Nearly 16 years ago, Maria abandoned young Delphinia and disappeared. The Albrights refuse even to mention her name. Then Harley, the groom's brother, asked Jemima to help him search for Maria and forestall the scandal that would surely follow if the prodigal parent turned up at the wedding. Jemima agrees and trudges through Hell's Kitchen to Fifth Avenue to the Lower East Side to Central Park. As Jemima travels through the strange, snowy streets, she never suspects she's walking into mortal danger. Saskia Malevelt narrates.
She smiled to herself and turned away from the railing in the wind. 23 and I'm thinking like a policeman. You'd be proud of me, Papa. And horrified. Shaking her head, she pulled up the collar of her coat and walked back toward the gangway down to the huge vestibule and the many formal rooms of the liner. She was passed by an elderly woman in a magnificent winter dress. The woman looked her up and down briefly, then nodded in acknowledgement.
"Good afternoon, Miss Pitt," she said coolly.
Jemima was surprised that the woman knew her name, and not certain if that was a compliment or not. Then she realized it was actually Finney the woman knew. Jemima was merely the companion. That was not an entirely pleasant thought.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Weatherby," she replied, lifting her chin a trifle higher, and walking on without waiting to see if there would be a conversation. She entered the cabin she and Finney shared, one of the more luxurious ones on the ship. It had both a bedroom and a quite comfortable-sized sitting room. Finney was there, curled up in one of the chairs. She was smaller than Jemima and just a trifle plumper, with large, dark eyes, her best features, and thick hair, almost black, with a natural curl that Jemima envied. Jemima's hair was a shining mahogany color, with gleams of amber she did not much like, and it had to be vigorously encouraged to have any curl at all. Finney looked up as Jemima came in. She had just finished writing in her diary, and now she carefully closed it and snapped the tiny lock shut.
"I shall want to remember this," she said with a smile. "I shall not be a single woman much longer. I may forget what it feels like."
"I shall remind you," Jemima replied, closing the door behind her and taking off her coat. She was glad to be in the warmth again. The wind off the ocean had a very sharp edge to it. Finney gave a tiny shrug of one shoulder.
"Oh, you may not always be single," she said cheerfully. "You really should turn your attention more fully to the subject. You do not need to be as fortunate as I am in order to be well suited."
A blistering retort rose to Jemima's lips, but she bit it back with difficulty. Finney's father was paying her fare, as she had been reminded twice already. She couldn't afford to alienate his daughter.
"Indeed, you are quite right," she said, walking across to the cupboard where she would hang up her coat.
She kept her back to Finney so the younger woman could not see the expression on her face.
"I would be content with far less," she added.
"That is very wise," Finney observed approvingly. "To know your own limits is halfway to happiness."
"What is the other half?"
Jemima asked, hanging up her coat and turning round.
"Knowing your husband's."
Finney was momentarily taken aback.
"Perhaps it is knowing his limits, but being careful not to tell him," Jemima said lightly. "Tact is a priceless virtue. It can cover a multitude of misfortunes, don't you think?"
"I don't know," Finney said instantly. "I don't have a multitude of misfortunes."
Jemima smiled. "Give it time. You are still very young."
Finney's smile vanished. Then, with an effort, she brought it back a trifle uncertainly.
"You say that as if you think something awful is going to happen."
That was A New York Christmas by Anne Perry. The novels of Debbie Macomber bring compelling relationships to life with stories that embrace family and enduring friendships, connection, and hope. Debbie has 170 million copies of her books in print. Her Cedar Cove books have become a popular series on the Hallmark Channel. Today we'll speak with Debbie about her new Christmas novel, Mr. Miracle, which will also be an original movie for the Hallmark Channel. A multi-talented woman, Debbie also owns her own tea room, Victorian Rose Tea Room, and Yarn Store, a Grand Yarn, named after the shop featured in her popular Blossom Street novels. Welcome, Debbie, and thanks for taking time out of your busy holiday season to visit with us on the Book Report.
Oh, it's my honor. I love this.
Thanks. Introduce us to Harry Mills, who I think is not exactly your run-of-the-mill guardian angel.
No, not at all. Harry is completely different. He is a permanent fixture at a community college. He's a literature teacher. And this is his first assignment to Earth. And he comes and he's just a little bit cocky because he's come from this perfect world of heaven to this imperfect world. And in a human form, and he's having to face human emotions. And his classroom now, every person in the classroom is an assignment for him, and so he works them one at a time. This is the setup for a TV series. This is what they call a backdoor to a TV series. The pilot will air on the Hallmark Channel, and so when I wrote the book, I had to create it, the story, as if it were an ongoing story with the characters.
I see. Well, tell us a little about Addie Folsom and Eric Simmons.
Addie is a lot like me in the fact that she's dyslexic and she struggled all through school. She was a rebellious teenager. She let her frustration and anger come out in negative ways. And she ran away, she didn't run away. She let her family know after a big fight with her parents that and she made a bunch of mistakes. She went out on her own without a high school education. And about 5 years later, she realizes that this was a terrible mistake. She needs her education. So she moves back home and signs up at this community college class to get her GED. And Eric is the perfect boy next door. He was the football star. You know, he was on homecoming court. He got good grades. And he taunted her. He just taunted her. And she grew up with an intense dislike for this young man. And then when she gets home, their mothers are best friends. They're both widows. They have planned this vacation for months to take a cruise over the holidays. And all of a sudden, Addie's home, and then Eric's in a car accident, and he needs help. He needs somebody there with him. And so Addie makes the sacrifice, because she doesn't like Eric, to go over and take care of him so their mothers can go on this much-needed vacation. And that's the whole premise of how the setup goes, where, he helps her, Harry Mills helps her to decide that this is the right thing to do. And so Addie takes on this assignment, so to speak, and creates a relationship with Eric that she never expected.
Right. I love that you had one angel, Celeste, working as a barista at a local coffee house. How did you come up with that stroke of brilliance?
Oh, well, Celeste, you get it, don't you? Celestial being.
Yes.
She was quite the character because she's real quirky. You know, she's got tattoos and piercings and she's cute and hip. And Harry comes and he thinks, this is not fair. How come I get the body of a middle-aged man and she's so cute?
Well, I liked him too. Now, I know you believe in angels because your dad had an experience with one. Would you share that?
Yeah, I will. It was towards the end of his life. He died about a week after this. He had a heart condition and he needed a walker, but he really disliked that walker and he resented the fact he had to use it. He got up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom, and when he finished, he realized he didn't have the strength to get back to bed. And he was leaning against the wall in the hallway thinking, what am I going to do now? And all of a sudden, there was a man in the hallway, and my dad was a farmer's son. And the man was dressed dressed as a farmer. He had on galoshes and coveralls, and just like my dad had worn as a kid. And I says, well, Dad, weren't you, you know, shocked to find somebody in the hallway like that? He said, no, I was more concerned about getting back to bed. And I said to the man, hey, buddy, I could use some help here. And he said the man came and put his arms around him and guided him back to bed, covered him up, and disappeared.
Wow.
And my dad told me he wasn't one to make up stories. I really believe it happened.
I do, too. We're speaking with Debbie May Comber on The Book Report. You know, when I read Mr. Miracle, I really felt it was about second chances. Tell us about Danny Wade and why you included him in the book.
Well, like I said, this is a setup for a TV series, so I had to create... It was really stretched me as an author and as a... Because every person, every secondary character in the book has their own story that can be all translated onto film later on. So Danny is the parole, the young man who's on parole. He's looking to make a better life. He wants to go straight. He's tired of dealing with prison and that lifestyle. He wants to make a positive change. So he's a great character. And then there's another character that's a returning vet who's gone through PTSD. And the Army, and a friend of mine, her grandson was injured in Iraq. And the Army gave him a dog. And the dog was instrumental in helping him deal with all of the frustrations and anger and a lot of the emotions he was having to deal with. So I gave my character the dog. And the dog is also an angel. My friend called it the comfort dog. So he has a comfort dog. Every character has a story. And it really was a wonderful experience to be able to create that.
Yeah, and it was wonderful to read it. Now, in Harry's English class, the first assignment was reading Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Not many of us know about the darker side of Dickens' childhood. Can you fill us in?
He was one of, I think, 6 or 8 children. And his father had terrible money problems and was thrown into debtor's prison. And at that time, the family went with him. But Charles's older sister, and he were of age where they could work. So the two of them ended up having to work to help their father get out of debt. And he worked in a terrible situation, and you can see what a profound impact that had on him in the other books that he wrote. He was very resentful towards his mother because even after his father got an inheritance and he was able to pay off his bills and get out of prison, but they still left the kids to work.
Oh, yeah.
And in these awful conditions. And so he never forgot that.
Mm-hmm. Well, each year, when do you start working on your Christmas novel?
Usually right around now. December, and then I finish it off in January. So I'm always already in the Christmas spirit.
Oh, that's good timing. And do you work on more than one book at a time?
I only write one book at a time, but I may end up having to work on, like I may have to do revisions or read page proofs or whatever, but I only create one at a time. But the goals that I set are generally with the books that I write. And because I'm a natural-born storyteller, early on in my career, I had to come up with a way of deciding what stories to develop, you know, what stories, what premise, because I have lots of story ideas. So I came up with words, and if the premise will align with these words, then... I can develop the story, and those words are relevant. The book, the idea has to be relevant to my readers' lives. It has to be provocative. I want my readers to think. It has to be entertaining. I'm not out there to preach or give statistics or do anything else, but I'm there. My job is as an entertainer, and it has to be realistic. I mean, this has to be believable. So those are the words that I use, and if the story idea can line up with those, then I'll go with it.
I see. Well, any final thoughts about Mr. Miracle?
I just think that it's one of the strongest Christmas books I've written, and I'm so proud that Rob Morrow chose to accept the role of the lead in this, and he just did a phenomenal job, and I hope everybody enjoys the book and the movie.
All right. Well, Debbie, thank you so much for joining us today and wishing you a wonderful holiday season.
Oh, thank you, Elaine.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Mr. Miracle, performed by Elise Mirto.
Addie unloaded her car, which sadly took only a few minutes. Everything she'd managed to accumulate in 6 years was contained in two suitcases and a couple boxes. When she finished unpacking, she headed directly for the garage. Her mother found her there 10 minutes later.
"Addie, my goodness, what are you doing here?" she asked. "I've been looking all over the house for you. Are you hungry? Would you like me to fix you something to eat?"
"In a little while."
"What are you doing?"
Addie stood in the middle of the garage, surrounded by several clear plastic boxes she'd brought down from the shelves. Her father had been a whiz at organization, a trait she'd inherited.
"I'm looking for the outdoor Christmas lights."
"But Addie, it won't feel like Christmas without the trees by the porch lit up."
"But Addie..."
"Mom, please let me put up the lights." Her dad would have wanted her to do this for her mother. Addie was sure. She owed him this, even if things hadn't been so good between them when he died, or maybe because of that.
"Eric offered to put them up for me, but I said no."
"Good. Perfect Eric." She bristled at the mere mention of his name. He'd always been so thoughtful and kind to others. But he tortured her at every opportunity. For one thing, from the time they were in first grade together, he'd insisted on calling her Adeline. Addie had always hated the name. She'd never even known the great-grandmother she'd been named after. Saddling her with that name had been her father's doing. No surprise. Her mother moved a couple steps into the garage.
There's a reason I didn't want Eric to put up the lights."
Addie straightened. Her mother's voice revealed hesitation and a bit of apprehension.
"What is it, Mom?" "I mentioned all those firsts without your father, remember?"
"Yes." It was one of the reasons Addie had returned home when she did. She didn't want her mother spending this first Christmas without Dad by herself. Jerry couldn't get away, but Addie could. Actually, she'd been more than ready to leave Montana. Although she'd come to love the state, everything else there had proved to be less perfect than she'd hoped. Her job at the mine had fizzled out after a few months, but pride hadn't allowed her to return home so soon after her grand departure. For a while, she drifted from job to job until finally settling in at the diner. She'd made friends and the tips were good. It was easy enough to coast through the next few years.
"I didn't say anything earlier when you called to say you were coming," her mother said, interrupting her thoughts.
Her mother wrung her hands.
"Mom, what is it?"
Clearly, there was something her mother didn't want to tell her.
"Please don't be upset with me."
This was all very strange.
"Mom, please don't worry. You're not going to upset me." "You're sure?"
"Positive. Just tell me." Her mother squeezed her eyes tightly shut.
"I'm going on a 2-week Christmas cruise with Julie Simmons."
It took a second for the information to sink in. "A cruise?" Her mother still hadn't opened her eyes.
"Julie's a widow. I'm a widow. We figured that we'd both get away this Christmas with a trip to the Caribbean. We booked a few days in Florida before the cruise as well. The sunshine and all. Please tell me you're not upset with me."
"Of course not," Addie assured her, although her heart sank. This meant she'd be spending Christmas alone.
"Julie and I talked about it for months, and then right before Halloween we found this great deal from the cruise line, and Julie said we should do it. If not now, when? I had no idea you'd be coming home, let alone for good, and... Oh, Addie, if you want, I'll cancel the trip."
Her voice became half plea and half regret. "No way," Addie insisted, strengthening her resolve. "You're going on that cruise, and you're going to enjoy every minute of it, while I hold down the fort here."
We've just heard Mr. Miracle by Debbie Maycomber. The next three selects are great last-minute gift ideas because there's always that one last person on your gift list. Rick Bragg, one of the great Southern storytellers, tracks down Jerry Lee Lewis and gets his own story from the source for the very first time. A monumental figure, Jerry Lee spent his childhood raising hell in Louisiana and Mississippi. He galvanized the world with hit records like Whole Lotta Shakin' Goin' On and Great Balls of Fire. Jerry Lee gave rock and roll its devil's edge, caused riots and boycotts with his incendiary performances, nearly scuttled his career by marrying his 13-year-old second cousin, ran a decades-long marathon of drugs, drinking, and women, suffered the deaths of two sons and two wives, and the indignity of an IRS raid that left him with nothing but the broken-down piano he started with. Jerry Lee performed with everyone, from Elvis to Keith Richards to Bruce Springsteen to Kid Rock, and survived it all to be hailed as one of the most creative and important figures in American pop culture and a paradigm of the Southern experience. John Pruden narrates.
As the drunken revelers lifted their glasses of bourbon high in the air, Elmo Kid Lewis pulled the boy to his hip. "Don't worry, son," Daddy told me. "That'll be you on there someday. That'll be you." He does not know if his daddy meant it would be him up there with the rich folks, the high and mighty, or if it would be his songs they played as the boat passed by. "I think maybe," he says, "it was both." Elmo knew it the way he knew wading in the river would get him wet. He had seen it, he and his wife, Mamie, when his son was barely 5 years old. Seen a power take over the boy's hands and guide them across a piano he had never studied or played before. For the boy, it was, well, he did not truly know. His fingers touched the keys and it was like he had grabbed a naked wire. But as it burned through him, it left him not scorched and scarred, but cool, calm, certain. "Only God did such as that," his mama said. And his daddy bought a piano for the boy so the miracle could proceed. Finally, something worth remembering. He rests now in the cool dark of his bedroom and lets it draw at the old poisons in him like a poultice. He is a swaggering man by nature, but for a moment there is no strut in him. "Mama and Daddy," he says, "believed in me." He tried to pay them back with houses and land and Cadillacs. "Money makes the mare trot," Mama always said. But the debt will never be settled. The piano, the weight of it, tilted the world. He still has it, that first piano, the wood cracked and buckled, deep grooves worn in its keys, in a dim hallway in a house where gold records and other awards pile like old newspapers or lean against a wall. He pauses before the ruined piano now, and then taps a single key. But what he hears is different from what other people do. The boat that taunted them is a ghost ship now. The old songs sank beneath the water. Elmo's boy, scoured by a worldly hell and toasted by kings, is still here. In the summers of 2011 and 2012, I listened in the quiet gloom of his bedroom as he told me what was worth remembering. He told me some of the rest of it, too. When he felt like it, for as long as he felt like it, he remembered it as it pleased him. That does not mean he always remembered it the same way twice, but day after day I was reminded of a line I once read. It was like any life, really, but with the dull parts taken out. It was odd, though, how he could see the boy on that levee so much clearer than he could see all the long life in between. Like he was looking across that wide river again, at himself. Before he rocked them, before the first piano bench went hurling across the stage and first shock of yellow hair tumbled into his snarling pretty face, and the first spellbound beautiful girl stared up from the footlights in unmistakable intent, he played Stick McGee songs for Coca-Cola money from the back of his daddy's beat-up flatbed Ford and sang Hank Williams before he knew what a heartache was. Before Memphis, before he took them from the VFW and convention halls to a place they'd not been even in a fever dream, before preachers and Parliament damned him for corrupting the youth of their nations, before he made Elvis cry, he listened to the Grand Ole Opry on his mother's radio, the battery she saved all week till Saturday night finally fading to nothing at the end of a Roy Acuff song. Before Bedlam, before he stacked money and hit records to the sun and blazed up, up, to come smoking to earth only to rise and fall and rise again. Before he outlasted almost all of his kind and proved on 10,000 stages that no amount of self-destruction could smother his voice or quiet the thunder in his left hand. Before John Lennon knelt and kissed his feet, he performed his first solo in the Texas Avenue Assembly of God, then hid under a table in Haney's Big House to see people grind to the Gut Bucket Blues.
That was Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story, by Rick Bragg. The Laughing Monsters is Dennis Johnson's high-suspense tale of kaleidoscoping loyalties in the post-9/11 world. After 10 years' absence, Roland Neyer returns to Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, to reunite with his friend Michael Adrigo. Years back, the pair made a bundle there during the country's civil war. Might good luck strike twice in the same place? Adrigo is an African who styles himself a soldier of fortune and who claims to have served in the Ghanaian army, the Kuwaiti Emiri Guard, and the American Green Berets. Adrico's stated reason for inviting Roland to Freetown is for him to meet Adrico's fiancée, an American grad student. Together, the three set out to visit Adrico's clan in the Uganda-Congo borderland, but each of these travelers is keeping secrets from the others. Shadowed by the Interpol, the Mossad, and MI6, Neyer gets married in a landscape of casual violence. The trio finds themselves journeying through a land abandoned by the future. Scott Shepard narrates.
The shuttle to the terminal wasn't bad, but not air-conditioned. Inside the building, the usual throng of fools. I studied the shining black faces, but I didn't see Michael's. The PA spoke, only the vowels came through. I called over the heads of the queue at the desk. Did I hear a page for Mr. Nair? No, sir, no, the man called back. Mr. Nair? Nothing for such a name. A man in a dark suit and necktie said, Welcome, Mr. Naylor, to Sierra Leone, and helped me through the mess and chatted with me all through customs, which didn't take long, because I'm all carry-on. He helped me outside to a clean white car, a Honda Prelude. And for me, he said, with a queasy-looking smile, $200. I gave him a couple of €1 coins. But, sir, he said, it's not enough today, sir. And I told him to shut up. The driver of the Honda wanted in the area of $1 million. I said, spendy money. And his face fell when he saw I knew some Creole. We reached an arrangement in the dozens. He couldn't go any lower because his heart was broken, he told me, by the criminal cost of fuel. At the ferry, there was trouble. A woman with a fruit cart, policemen in sky blue uniforms throwing her goods into the bay while she screamed as if they were drowning her children. It took 3 cops to drag her aside as our car thumped over the gangway. I got out and went to the rail to catch the wet breeze. On the shore, the uniforms crossed their arms over their chests. One of them kicked over the woman's cart, now empty. Back and forth she marched, screaming. The scene grew smaller and smaller as the ferry pulled out into the bay, and I crossed the deck to watch Freetown coming at us, a mass of buildings, many of them crumbling, and all around them a multitude of shadows and muddy rags trudging God knows where, hunched forward over their empty bellies. At the Freetown dock, I recognized a man, a skinny old Euro named Horst, standing beside a hired car with his hand shading his eyes against the sunset, taking note of the new arrivals. As our vehicle passed him, I slumped in my seat and turned my face away. After we'd passed, I kept an eye on him. He got back in his car without taking on any riders. Horst. His first name was something like Cosmo, but not Cosmo. Leo, Rollo. I couldn't remember. I directed Emil, my driver, to the Papa Leon, as far as I knew. The only place to go for steady electric power and a swimming pool. As we pulled under the hotel's awning, another car came at us, swerved, recovered, sped past, with a sign in its window, Splendid Driving School. This resembled commerce, but I wasn't feeling the new Africa. I locked eyes with a young girl loitering right across the street, selling herself. Poor and dirty, and very pretty, and very young. I asked Emil how many kids he had. He said there were 10, but 6 of them died. Emil tried to change my mind about the hotel, saying the place had become very demoted. But inside, the electric lights burned, and the spacious lobby smelled clean, or poisonous, depending on your opinion of certain chemicals. And everything looked fine. I'd heard the rebels had shot it out with the authorities in the hallways, but that had been a decade before, just after I'd run away. And I could see they'd patched it all up. The clerk checked me in without a reservation and then surprised me. Mr. Neer, a message. Not from Michael, from the management, in purple ink, welcoming me to the solution to all your problems, and crafted in a very fine hand. It was addressed to whom it may concern. Clipped to it was a slip of paper, instructions for getting online. The desk clerk said the internet was down, but not always, maybe tonight.
We've just heard The Laughing Monsters by Dennis Johnson. Pompeii, Machu Picchu, the Valley of the Kings, the Parthenon. The names of these legendary archaeological sites conjure up romance and mystery. Archaeological research tantalizes us with possibilities. But where are the archaeologists behind these stories? What kind of work do they actually do? And why does it matter? Marilyn Johnson's Lives in Ruins is an absorbing and entertaining look at the lives of contemporary archaeologists as they sweat under the sun for clues to the puzzle of our past. Johnson digs and drinks alongside men and women as adventurous as Indiana Jones. Her subjects share stories about slaves and Ice Age hunters, Chinese women warriors, sunken fleets, and mummies. What drives these archaeologists is not the money, which is meager, the jobs, which are scarce, or their working conditions, oftentimes quite dangerous, but their passion for stories that would otherwise be buried. Hilary Huber narrates.
I really wanted to see the earth through archaeologists' eyes. What do they observe in a pile of ruins? How does a shard of pottery or an ancient tooth help them piece together the past? How can they help us recapture and preserve our history? I chased the real thing for this book, up to the summit of Machu Picchu and down to the chilly waters of Newport, Rhode Island. I became a keen collector of archaeologists and a connoisseur of their skills. I sought experts on different eras who specialize in a variety of artifacts. I hunted for archaeologists in places that don't ordinarily attract archaeological attention. The Caribbean and the weedy edge of Fishkill, New York, where archaeologists piece together history, post-Columbus, from plantations and graves. I found my way to a classical era excavation in the Mediterranean with a group of earth whisperers and got a taste of old world archaeology from the Bronze Age to the fall of Rome. I studied ancient humans and followed an archaeologist whose passion is the Ice Age. I followed archaeologists who work with the military, with homicide cops, and with brewers. I met archaeologists from Peru, Japan, Australia, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Israel, and Zimbabwe. I found as many female sources as male ones in this once male-dominated field. I sweated and excavated alongside my guides. They tossed out most of what I found. In turn, I exercised my own prerogative as a writer and tossed out all the chaff, jargon, measurements, calibrated radiocarbon dates, and theories that seemed too needlessly technical for non-scientists, or that failed to illuminate the essential character of the archaeologist. What does it take to spend your life scratching into the surface of this planet? Why does it matter? And, by the way, how much beer is involved? Such is the nature of my quest. One graduate student told me, "When the apocalypse comes, you want to know an archaeologist, because we know how to make fire, catch food, and create hill forts." And I promptly added her to my address book. Knows how to make hill forts. Who can say when that will come in handy? Of course, she continued, referring to the long-term employment prospects for her and her classmates, we will end up living in cardboard boxes, just as our parents fear. Archaeological fieldwork is messy, usually short-term work for hire, assessing land for imminent development, to certify that this skyscraper or that pipeline or strip mall won't destroy an ancient village or a sacred burial ground. Those who persevere in the profession fight like cats to get these jobs and work like dogs to keep them. And for all their expertise, competence, breadth of experience, and even cockiness, they are continually humbled by their subject. For people who know so much, there is so much they can never know. One archaeologist said with a shrug, "Someone will find most of my first book all wrong." And another said of his students, "What they'll know in 10 years will put us to shame." I was drawn to those with experience, long-term perspective, scars, and stories, the toughest I could find. 4 years ago, I stood in the National Museum of Ireland Archaeology in Dublin, contemplating vast quantities of ancient gold objects churned up by the bogs of Ireland. Hammered collars, big gold balls, gold diadems and bracelets, and things to stick in your ears, they think. At the time, the Irish economy was tanking. Dublin was running, as far as I could tell, on what spilled out of the pockets of Brits during their bachelor parties. And yet here was all this gold, artifacts floating in display cases like jewelry from Brobdingnag.
That was Lives in Ruins by Marilyn Johnson. Many readers believe it isn't Christmas without a Richard Paul Evans novel. In The Mistletoe Promise, this year's edition, Elise and Nicholas are two souls who find themselves alone and lonely with the holiday season approaching. Nick, a successful lawyer, proposes they enter into a mutually beneficial contract to act as a couple for all the upcoming social events. Elise is intrigued. January Lavoie performs this story of hope and light at this magical time of year.
That weekend, all I could think about was the proposition. Who was this guy, and what did he want? What was his motive? I suppose on a deeper level, the bigger question, considering how lonely I was why was I even questioning his motive? Why couldn't he be exactly what he claimed to be? Was that really so hard to accept? My father used to say, "If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But if it's already broke, it don't matter what you do." My life was definitely broken. So why not? Really, what did I have to lose? I even asked myself, what would Zoe do? I knew what she'd do. She'd say, "You only live once, girl," and she'd buckle up for the ride. I suppose that my mind was probably somewhere in Zoe land when I decided to say yes. The next Monday, Nicholas arrived in the food court about a half hour after I'd started eating.
"Hi, Elise," he said. "How's your salad?"
"Good."
"How was your weekend?"
"The usual," I said, even though it was definitely anything but. He sat down across from me.
"Did you come to a decision?"
"Right to the point," I said. I set down my plastic fork. So, hypothetically, let's say that I said yes. What would this arrangement look like? He smiled.
First, we write up a contract.
Why? You don't trust me?
Contracts are not always so much a matter of trust as they are a matter of understanding. This way, we'll be more likely to meet each other's expectations.
I should have had one of those before my marriage, I thought. He leaned in closer.
Let me tell you what I had in mind. I'll pay for all meals, transportation, and admissions. We'll have lunch together when possible, and in addition to the social functions, I'll take you to dinner or some holiday-themed event at least once a week, and I'll send you something, a gift, each weekday up until the end of the contract. Then, at midnight on Christmas Eve, the agreement terminates, and we go back to our lonely, pathetic lives.
If I agree, how do we start?
We'll begin by going through each other's calendars and determining what events we can attend. It's two-sided, of course. If you'd like, I'll attend your events as well.
I thought a moment more, then with his eyes locked onto mine, said, All right.
All right, let's do it?
He asked. I nodded.
Yes. Let's do it. Are you sure?
Why not? Lunch every day?
When possible. At least every workday. We're 2 days in on that now. It hasn't been too painful, has it?
It's definitely been interesting. I don't know about you sending me things.
Why?
I shrugged. I don't know.
You'll get used to it.
Do I have to send you things, too?
No. I expect nothing but the pleasure of your company.
I took a deep breath. Okay, get me a contract.
Great, he said, standing. I'll see you tomorrow.
You're not having lunch?
No, I have a deposition in an hour that I still need to prepare for. I just came down to see you.
Something about the way he said that pleased me. All right, I'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Elise. I don't think you'll regret it.
A minute later, a food court worker said to me, You have a cute husband. He's not my husband, I said. I paused. He's my boyfriend. Lucky you, she said.
That was The Mistletoe Promise by Richard Paul Evans. Audiobook enthusiasts know Pete Larkin as one of their favorite performers. But Pete has worked in virtually all media. For 6 years, he was the public address announcer for the New York Mets. He's been a popular radio jock in Baltimore, Washington, and New York. He's an award-winning on-camera host, has performed in hundreds of commercials, and has starred in a wide range of dramas, comedies, and musical roles in the theater. Today, Pete's got a special holiday treat for us, so let's listen.
Was the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap, when out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment He must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk. And laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Readers, from our book report family to yours, from Derek Hewitt, executive producer.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Have a wonderful holiday and a perfect new year.
Steve Johnson, studio producer.
Ho, ho, ho. Happy holidays, everybody.
Dave Hain, audio producer.
And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that truly be said of all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
And Ole Vargas, studio manager.
Hi, everybody. Have a great holiday. Happy New Year. And cheers from Outpost Audio.
We wish you and yours a storybook holiday filled with friends and family, laughter and love. Thank you so much for joining us during this busy time of year. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report. Happy Holidays.